Hello and welcome to Let the Stones Speak. My name is Christopher Eames and I'll be your host for today's program. Today we've got a very special interview for you, an on-site interview at Tel Shiloh, Biblical Shiloh, with Dr. Scott Stripling. Dr. Stripling is the excavation director at Tel Shiloh on behalf of the Associates of Biblical Research team. He's also the provost at the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas. And he was kind enough to grant us this interview on this, their final day of excavation. Now, typically we like to do an interview with Dr. Stripling toward the end of their excavation season. But this year, I'd completely forgotten about it. And then yesterday, for whatever reason, Tel Shiloh came to mind. And I quickly emailed Dr. Stripling, hoping that we hadn't missed them. And he was kind enough to email that evening and say there's actually one more day left of excavation, so to come along and do the interview. So that we did earlier today. We're very grateful to Dr. Stripling for granting us that and for some of the scoop information that he provided on this interview. Some really interesting new discoveries that have been made at Tel Shiloh, including some amazing gold items. So definitely stay tuned for that. But before we get into the interview, I do want to plug our magazine. This is the latest edition, which is hitting mailboxes right now here in Israel. I think many of our subscribers elsewhere in the world, in America especially, have already received their magazine. So if you're interested in biblical archaeology, please do subscribe to this magazine. It's a bi-monthly magazine. It's absolutely free. 40 pages, high quality. So do subscribe to the magazine. You've got nothing to lose. And we'll leave the links in the description to do so. And then finally, if you're able, do go and visit our exhibit in Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered exhibit. And this is the special exhibit edition of the magazine. It's an expanded triple length magazine, so if you'd like to order this specifically, you can do so again on our website, armstronginstitute.org, and again, the links for that will be in the show notes. But there's a lot of amazing discoveries relating to King David and Solomon that you can find in this magazine and then also in our exhibit. And if you're unable to visit the exhibit in person yourself, we do have a virtual tour available of the exhibit online, so do go and check that out. If you enjoy the content, please do go ahead and like and subscribe. And without further ado, we'll jump to the interview. Enjoy. Dr. Stripling.
Chris Eames.
Thank you so very much. It's an honor to be here and for taking time out last minute to have this interview with us on the final day of your excavation.
Well, not just the final day, the final hour, okay?
Literally.
So yeah, welcome to Tel Shiloh.
Yeah, thank you very much. This is the fourth or fifth time I think we've come out to do a final interview at the end of the dig. And I think this must be nearly 10 years for you at the site. Was it 2016?
Yeah, 2016, when we transitioned from Kerbel Makkadar to Shiloh.
Great. So yeah, when we come out here, we can see how much the site goes down over that period of time.
Pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible, the amount of earthwork. And typically, this is one of the largest excavations, I think,
right
here in Israel. Why don't you tell us about just this year in particular? Obviously, we've got the elephant in the room, the war situation going on. So I wonder if that's changed things up about the season. Kudos to you and your team for coming out.
Well, my team deserves a lot of credit. These are people who, they've been with me through thick and thin. I mean, you name it, that we've excavated in the snow together and through wars and pandemics and intifadas. And these guys, you couldn't scare them off if you wanted to. But we did have 222 last season. I had 75 this season. So I was grateful for those 75, and we had amazing results considering all those things.
So as far as the areas themselves, I recall last year there were a few main areas of concentration. You've got your Favisa site on the northeast, I think, and then your cultic area, maybe tabernacle area here, and then the gate area. So is it more or less the same?
You nailed it. Okay, so three things. We're working in area H, area K, and area D. So here in H, we have what we think is the gate, and a monumental building that spans H and K that indeed could be the building of the tabernacle.
Okay, so I recall last year you said it seems like it's a strong candidate for the Tabernacle, something like that. Has your opinion shifted at all this season? Stronger, weaker to that end?
Well, I would say maybe a little stronger. We still have more excavation to do. It seems clear that it's about 25 meters long and about 12 and a half meters wide. The walls are massive. They're 1.2 meters wide, 3 meters in preservation of height. And this is from LB2, Iron Age 1. Mm-hmm. There is no other building, to my knowledge, in Israel from that time period of that size. It happens to be at Shiloh, and it happens to be east-west. And within that, we have found, as you know, in the past, we've talked about some of the cultic items. This year, another pomegranate, a miniature pomegranate, a pendant that's like a faience, sort of a bead, and right in the center of what the Holy of Holies would be. So,
wow. Is that the third pomegranate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, third pomegranate.
Yeah.
Yeah, from the building.
Amazing.
And from wet sifting. If we weren't wet sifting, we would have thrown it away.
Okay, you wet sift all the stuff you excavate
here? We do.
Okay. And I know in the past you've also found altar horns and along with the pomegranates. And you also had mentioned gold items as well, I think from the Favisa deposit area. More of the same type of...
More this year, more gold. It's really interesting. Most archaeologists work their entire career and never find gold. Mm. And we've been fortunate to find 6 pieces so far in Area D where we're excavating. And these are clearly offerings. People do not lose gold in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. And these are all pendants, and so they're intentionally placed here, along with the bones from the sacrificial system, the pottery from the late bronze, beautiful bichrome restorable vessels, and then we find these special items.
Right.
And among the pottery are chalices, dozens this season, dozens more chalices, which are, again, have a cultic function.
For sure. So that would be my question about the gold items. Are these more like Hacksilver type pieces, or are they actually complete? You're saying
no, they're type? Pendants. Gold stars.
Okay.
Gold
like
spoon.
Like 5-pointed stars, or multiple.
Eight pointed.
Okay.
Yes. So they're known from the late Bronze Age. Okay. They're a type. So it seems like these are regular valuable items that people have. Maybe the most valuable thing that they have that they're offering to the Lord. These are being given over. And the most astounding one came from this season. And I suppose you'd like to know what that was.
Yes, I would. I don't know how much you can say about anything I ask about, but whatever you can divulge.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. I can't show you a picture right now, but it was another gold pendant, very thin gold, sheet gold. And I had it cleaned immediately with our conservator, Orna Cohen. And Orna sent me an email and said, "You're not going to believe this." And when I opened it, there was a human face on this pendant.
Wow.
3,300, 3,400 year old, whatever, yeah. Gold pendant dating to the late Bronze Age. And a man with a beard. And so I haven't literally had time to analyze it.
Wow.
This was 2 weeks ago, and I'm just waiting for till I have time to do this. That will be on the cover of one of our volumes of publication, probably.
For sure, yeah. And we'll point people to that when that comes out. I'm excited to see that.
Yeah.
Boy, that's amazing. And you're talking a lot about the LB as well, the late bronze material. And obviously this gets into the whole debate about when did the Israelites come into the land? When was this early site operational? Was it late bronze, or was it more at the start of the Iron One period? Also, you talked about that a little bit last year, like are you seeing more of one or the other? So you were pointing more toward the LB2 period. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing more of the same?
I think we understand it even better this year with so much more pottery that we have. And I also did carbon dating from last year's bones too, and it gave me an LB2A date as well.
Okay.
So I'm more convinced that the horizon is around LB2A for the beginning of this Favisa, which would match, I believe, when the Israelites would have arrived at Shiloh. And so we see this going on down to the Iron One period.
Mm-hmm.
So we have from LB2A down to Iron One, we see this Favisa being deposited. There's microstratigraphy within it. So it's a deposition over a period of time.
Okay. And so that would put us about the 14th century for the start of that period.
Yeah.
And for the favisa itself, is that quite a time-consuming process? Like you're actually delineating these very fine layers in the field?
Right. Well, that we're attempting to do so.
Right.
We're also doing some luminescence testing of the soil to sort of confirm what we think that we're seeing. But a lot of eyes, one of my students, Jordan McClinton, is doing his PhD on Area D. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working very closely with Jordan in that area. And then some of our other professional archaeologists, like Haskell Greenfield and others, are giving us close eyes over there. We don't get a second chance, Chris. Mm-hmm. You know, if we mess it up, we can't go back and repeat the experiment.
Right.
So trying to be really careful, do it right, and bring all the knowledge, all the science that we have to bear, so that in the end, when we tie a bow on it and walk away, we feel like we really did an excellent job.
Right. Yeah, I know how tricky that is from our excavations in Jerusalem, when you're just going from top down and trying to pick up all that stratigraphy, especially when it's very finely laid like that. It's much easier if you start from a section and you can,
well,
you can see.
Well, we had the benefit of that because the Bar Ilan excavation in the 1980s left balks.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to trim the balks and then anticipate. And so when we're in new areas, at least we have some advantage because of that.
That's perfect then. Yeah. That's what we're hoping to do back at our site. We've left some sections, and next time we want to go more carefully through that. So the gate, you did a bit more excavation there. Anything more from that area? It's becoming more obvious, the layout of it, or?
Yeah, the big breakthrough for this season is we have the pavement. We have the flooring. In situ flooring in the gate.
Are we talking limestone, crushed limestone?
No, not crushed, paved lime.
Wow.
Limestone pavers in situ, and about 100 that are not in situ above it, but then the actual pavement. And this is the Bronze Age gate, you understand. So this would have been the gate that Joshua would have seen when he arrived and probably walked through this threshold. The pavers are geometric, Chris.
Okay.
Diamonds, triangles, rectangles, hexagonal shapes. My mind is blown because
Amazing.
We know this from the Second Temple period, right? The Opus Sectile stones
right.
and how Frankie Snyder, who's part of my team, cracked the code for the Second Temple flooring. But in the Bronze Age, we just keep looking at each other saying, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So we're just now, we haven't had time to study it yet, but we'll start trying to figure out. That's what's great about being an archaeologist. You learn something new every day.
Right.
None of us thought that these things existed at that time, and now we know that they did.
That's amazing, especially the link with the temple and the floor layer.
Right, right. Will and Frankie, the same one who cracked the code for the Herodian temple, is the one that we're going to task her with her geometry background to reconstruct this floor for us.
Amazing. Looking forward to seeing the results of that as well. So anything more from so that's the favisa and the gate. Anything more exactly from the potential tabernacle site itself? Were you excavating against the outer walls or inside?
Well, both, outside and inside. It's really nice because we've been excavating there for enough seasons that we can see the complete cross section, the stratigraphy. We have found floor level. And so now as we're going down in other areas, we can anticipate what those levels are and match them up. It seems clear to me now because the foundation trenches have great foundation trenches. These are big walls, so they have big foundation trenches. So the pottery has confirmed my hypothesis that it's built toward the end of the LB and it's in use down to about 1075 BC on into the Iron One period. If we're going to take the Seder Olam and the Zavayim at face value, then this was a building with a tent over the top of it as a roof. And the preservation is phenomenal, like up to 3 meters in some places. It was the site was destroyed for sure around 1075 BC. We have a destruction level, probably the Philistine destruction of Shiloh.
Okay, you were finding more of that this season,
yes.
I recall that last.
So we're confident of that in our cross sections. Mm-hmm. And now we know that there was an LB2A rebuild site-wide.
Okay.
So the cross walls that seem out of context, now that we've gotten deeper, we see the older wall underneath it. So that's a rebuild in the LB2A. That's when the silos were cut all around the site too.
Got it, okay. So yeah, I guess for a lot of people that would be the question regarding the tabernacle. Like we're talking in terms of stone walls. Wasn't the tabernacle a tent structure? What you're saying is you've got these stone walls and then the tent which more or less went over the top of it.
That's how I'm picturing it, yeah.
Okay. and the dimensions match up as well, like you said.
It's very close. I mean, our problem is that we don't know exactly what a cubit was, but
right.
if we're more or less understanding it, then we're looking for, more importantly than the exact dimensions, would be the 2-to-1 ratios. So,
right.
you know, it's east-west, it's 2-to-1, 25 meters long, 12 and a half meters wide. So the symmetry and the dimensions and the orientation are what suggest to me that that's what it is. I had a senior archaeologist visit recently, and he was skeptical when we started talking. And then at the end, he said, well, if it's not, then that means you have two buildings of the same dimensions at the same time at the same place. And that seems weird.
Right.
So
when you look at the Solomonic gates, for example, you've got the layouts of those, and we can more or less tell that it seems like they were using an Egyptian cubit, which is the royal cubit, the longer cubit. Versus some other things with the shorter cubit, the arm and a span. So you haven't really been able to say, like, if they were using either or it's more rough, the measurements?
No, I haven't nailed it down to that level yet. But I hope to, you know, get more precise. Yeah. And now another one of my team, Tim Lopez, is doing his PhD on this building. He's about to start at Ariel.
Okay.
On his PhD program, and his dissertation topic is this building.
Okay.
And so Tim and I, just like Jordan and I, are researching Area D closely together. Tim and I researching this closely. Abigail's finishing her PhD now also on the transition between LB2 and Iron 1. This is what you would want out of a dig, right?
You would want
young researchers, young archaeologists to come and not just dig, but to hone their skills and publish and then walk away as trained, skilled archaeologists.
For sure, and it helps in some ways just speed up the work you can put out as well, so that's not all on your head or this or that other individual's head. And you work closely together, obviously, as well, which is ideal. So are you planning for a season next year? Same deal,
There would have to be something unforeseen to keep us away, because we would have come during COVID if they would have let us. And with the war going on, that didn't stop us. So I would be shocked if we're not in the field next summer in probably 4 more years.
Okay, well, we'll hope to see you next year then. Thank you so much for doing this interview with us, Dr.
Thanks for all your good work, Chris.
My pleasure. We'll see you around.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.